From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Paul Monnett. A few years ago, he wrote an eloquent memoir about caring for his lover who died of AIDS. Since then, Monnett has lost a second lover to the disease. Recently, Monnett was himself diagnosed with AIDS. Also today, Lost in the City, we meet writer Ed Jones. He's just completed his first book, a collection of short stories about life in an African-American neighborhood in Washington, D.C. And book critic John Leonard reviews Watermark by Nobel Prize winner Joseph Brodsky. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After spending nearly all month on the road, President Bush is back at the White House, staking his claim to be the agent of change. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Although he says his campaign hasn't really started, Mr. Bush will be traveling more soon. This week he'll be in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Ohio, and Missouri. Today he all but accused Bill Clinton of stealing his campaign theme.
I loved it when I'm told that my opponent, one of them, I guess, at the convention said, well, we've changed the world, now let's change America. Hey, a Democratic candidate dropped out of the race for plagiarism last year. This is a comment that I've been saying.
Mr. Bush was referring to Democratic Senator Joseph Biden, who dropped out of the 1988 presidential race after it was revealed that he had plagiarized a campaign speech. Despite the comparison, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says he doubts the Bush team will ever get as negative as the Clinton campaign. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Aides to President Bush are spreading the word that the president has asked his old friend James Baker to leave his post as Secretary of State and take charge of the Bush-Quayle reelection campaign. Baker is credited with reviving the Bush campaign in 1988. Speaking on condition of anonymity, the aides told UPI that the president wants Baker to take a leave of absence at the State Department. Health officials are speaking at the International AIDS Conference being held in Amsterdam, told participants there are now an estimated 12 million adults and 1 million children infected with the virus associated with AIDS. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
Dr. Michael Merson, who heads the AIDS division of the World Health Organization, said the epidemic is no longer clustered in cities, mostly among men. The AIDS epidemic today, he says, is in the countryside, and it's infecting women, especially young women, and especially in Africa. In one recent study, more than a quarter of all the women attending one health clinic in Rwanda who were infected with the virus said they had only one lifetime sex partner. Health officials say this shows that men are more likely to have multiple partners than women, and that women at high risk must learn how to negotiate safer sex with their partners. And despite greater knowledge worldwide that condoms can prevent transmission of the virus, condom use, say health officials, is still not routine. In Amsterdam, I'm Patricia Naimond reporting.
A Pentagon spokesman said that there were seven people aboard the V-22 Osprey prototype aircraft that crashed today in Virginia. A search and rescue operation has found no known survivors. The controversial plane is being developed for the Marine Corps. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 29 points to finish at 3,303. Declines led advances by a margin of nearly 2-1 in active trading. This is NPR News. Two United Nations soldiers were slightly injured today by a car bomb in the northern Iraqi city of Sulaymaniyah. The soldiers were part of a unit assigned to guard UN personnel who were distributing aid in the Kurdish region of Iraq. South African authorities today postponed formal charges against 78 men accused of murder and public disturbance in last month's massacre in the black township of Boipatong. Officials said the men will be charged early next month. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Prosecutors said the delay is necessary in order to complete their investigations of the Bui Patong rampage, in which more than 40 people died. All of the suspects will remain in custody while the process is finished. The men, some as young as 15, are residents of a workers' hostel near Bui Patong. The massacre there derailed political talks on South Africa's future and prompted the African National Congress to seek United Nations intervention to resolve the impasse. UN Special Envoy Cyrus Vance is expected to arrive here tomorrow for a 10-day visit to study township violence and search for a way to revive the political negotiations. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
The New York Times reported today that the nation's largest private health insurance company is under investigation by federal and state regulators. The newspaper said that government officials are probing allegedly irregular business practices that have put at least a dozen Blue Cross and Blue Shield health plans in financial trouble. The report said the questionable business practices allegedly included the payment of high salaries to executives of plans that are nearly insolvent. The Times quoted Bernard Tresnowski, the president of the National Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, as saying that 15 plans are on the watch list. Tresnowski said that certain plans didn't meet the association's standards for financial reserves, but he denied that any of them are close to insolvency. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few years ago, I interviewed Paul Monette after he'd written a very moving memoir about caring for his lover Roger Horowitz as he died of AIDS. They had been together over 10 years. Last September, Monette lost another lover to the disease. I was recently sorry to learn that Monette has been diagnosed with AIDS. In Monette's new memoir, he writes, "Death by AIDS is everywhere around me." But most of Monette's new book is about a time before the epidemic when he was coming of age but couldn't come out of the closet. The book is called Becoming a Man. I found myself thinking back to the opening of his 1988 memoir about his lover's illness. That book began, "I don't know if I will live to finish this. All I know is this, the virus ticks in me. I used up all my optimism keeping my friend alive." I asked Paul Monette how those words sound to him now.
They seem very prophetic to me now. I worried, actually, when I finished that book that people would find them too melodramatic, because I certainly didn't die. And as I have gone on crying in the wilderness about AIDS, I've had many more years since I wrote those words. But it has finally hooked its talons in me, and the last 6 months have been fairly harrowing. What is poignant, Terry, is that I really did have I came back to a level of optimism, I think, a couple of years ago, when I really believed, along with a lot of other AIDS activists, that we were on the brink of turning AIDS into a chronic, manageable illness. That was our phrase, and that was our hope. And it really seemed to be backed up by the excitement in the medical community. That has changed. There's a much more of a sense of darkness and despair and how hard the long term is going to be in the AIDS activism community now. I think ultimately we will turn this into that chronic manageable illness, but I will not live to see it.
When did you start getting sick?
Well, I was diagnosed, Terry, in mid-December of 91, about 7 or 8 months ago. And I had had fevers over a period of 5 or 6 months. My numbers, that is my T4 helper cells, had been skydiving down in the previous 6 months. And we knew that there was something struggling to break through. It turned out to be a very, very exotic and rare fungus in my blood. And I was given a treatment for it, and I developed an allergy to the treatment that nearly killed me. I think we're beginning to find out. I've now proved allergic to 8 different drugs in the last year and a half, and the AIDS community of doctors is beginning to notice more and more of that, and that's a really crucial subject to try to address. I may have to go into the hospital to try to be desensitized to one of the sulfa drugs. So I was really sick for about a month and a half with that. And unhappily, one of the treatments for this condition that I had, called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, was using steroids. And steroids can induce Kaposi's sarcoma. So I suddenly found myself getting lesions in February and March. And
as a result of the steroids?
Yes, yes. That kind of is a kind of an ignition for KS lesions. I haven't had a lot of trouble with KS since it started. About a month ago, I was about to leave on my book tour for Becoming a Man, and the day before, I decided, I don't know, some old hypochondria told me to have a brain scan because I've been having headaches. Not bad, I'm not a headachey kind of person, but it turned out to be toxoplasmosis, 3 lesions in my brain, so I had to go into the hospital to be treated for that. I look very well, and I feel reasonably well, too. I really do. I mean, depression to the contrary, notwithstanding, one of the irritating things you find when you deal with people with AIDS is that people do not like particularly to hear their friends say, "You look great, you look great." There's something distancing about that, because we can look great and be taking so much medication it would kill a horse, and living in the dread between infections.
Yeah. You've taken care of 2 lovers who died of AIDS. Do you have a lover now to help take care of you?
I do. I've been very fortunate, and I've met a wonderful, strong man who buried a lover to AIDS about, nearly a year ago now, 8 or 9 months ago. His name is Winston, and, we understand that we're loving in the midst of war, and that the bombs could go off at any moment. It's a very difficult position to be in, though. It was difficult enough to care for somebody and to watch them die and to be unsure about when that's going to happen. It's heartbreaking to be in the position of being sick and to watch someone else worry.
Are there times when you look at your lover and see yourself? Because you've been through this?
Oh, so much. I so much see the a kind of quality of positive denial, whereby he is able to or insists on maintaining a positive attitude about it and me, and that reminds me very much of how I got through with Roger during those 20 months. I felt in a way that one mistake I had made in treating Roger and in caring for him was that I really hadn't talked much with him about death. And I remember my therapist said to me after Roger died, and I was feeling guilty about that, "Well, guess what? You would have had a conversation and you would have both decided that death sucked, and that would have been that." I mean, I think that's probably true. I don't know what to say about death, and here I am facing it.
What's one of the most difficult things that you had to do for Roger when he was sick that, your lover has to do for you now? Is there something like that?
Not yet. I actually had to deliver an enormous amount of medication to Roger because he was getting 3 IVs a day, and he was blind at the time, so he couldn't really do it himself. And a nurse came in for one of them, and I picked up 2 of those, and I don't remember that unhappily. It's just that had to happen for about 6 months. And Winston is now helping me keep my PICC line, my IV line, clean by flushing it for me at night. So that echoes that in the past. And fortunately, I have not as yet lost my peculiar and ravenous appetite, so he hasn't had to be the food Nazi, which is really was one of the difficult things with Roger and Stephen, and a place where a lot of anger gets blown off, I think.
But you had to force them to eat?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
You know so much about AIDS now because you've lost friends and 2 lovers, and you've taken care of people. Is it good to be that informed about a disease that you now have, or do you sometimes wish you were a little more ignorant about it?
Well, I have a healthy respect for people who are maybe hip deep in it, who maintain a certain ignorance even as they are. I am the sort of person who wants to know. It may be the writer in me that just has to know. It's very dismaying to sometimes be in a doctor's office and feel I know more than they do. I have very good doctors and very good medical attention available to me, and I have doctors who will talk straight with me as well. But I sometimes feel like a lay microbiologist, and all the test tubes have been smashed. I don't know what to do with all the knowledge sometimes. And it's very painful, as Elizabeth Glaser said at the convention, that I have all these medications available to me, and 99.5% of the people who are suffering from HIV infection have none of those drugs available. I mean, even though the drug companies have been scandalously slow in getting drugs to us, and even though the Bush and Reagan governments have been virtually genocidal in keeping treatment from us, we've managed to get it. We've developed an underground to go after that medication. And if you're a person with color or a poor woman, you're not going to get those drugs. They just, you know, you're just going to die.
I'm wondering how much things have changed since Roger was sick. He died, I believe, in 87?
He died in October of 86, Terry, and it's very good question. The place where we have made real progress is in prophylaxis. That is, in finding drugs that will keep some of the really horrendous infections from taking over.
So you have drugs now that he didn't have access to?
Oh, many, many, many. I mean, I've been on AZT for 4 years, to a point where it really doesn't work for me anymore. But I really had a very long period of time where I was stable because of AZT, I believe. And Roger was the first patient outside of Bethesda to get AZT in 85, and we didn't understand it. We were pouring it out of IV bottles into orange juice. I mean, they hadn't even retooled a factory yet, and I think it gave him 8 or 10 more months of life, though they were difficult months. That's just one example, but there are, you know, we've now found some ways to protect against pneumocystis pneumonia, to protect against toxoplasmosis, which is the one I've got right now. And so maybe 3 or 4 major infections have been challenged by excellent research and imaginative application of medication. So that is one small bit of progress.
What about the support system in the community? Is that any stronger or weaker?
It's in a way it's broader, and it breaks your heart to meet people who have been ravaged by AIDS, by losing someone, and to see how many people want to keep fighting because they know that this terrible injustice happened to them. I think that, however, we are burnt out beyond any scale that anyone can really understand. So psychologists have said to me that, you know, we can understand what people feel about grieving over someone who dies, even in a ghastly way, but so many people in the gay community have lost 10 and 20 and 30 friends. Almost everyone I know would say they've lost 100 or 200 people. And it becomes difficult to respond. When Stephen died, I could not cry. I mean, the numbness was worse than the grief. And I'm not sure that the grief, of course the grief came out one way or another, but it wasn't a clean, crying, keening grief at all. That my mother died 2 years ago, and 6 months later I was saying to people, as soon as I have a feeling, I'll let you know. The terrible cost of all this suffering on the heart is that the fear is that it will make the heart dead. I think Holocaust survivors would relate to some of those same issues.
My guest is writer Paul Monette. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Paul Monette. His new book is a memoir called Becoming a Man. His 1988 memoir, Borrowed Time, was about his life with his longtime lover, Roger Hurwitz, after Hurwitz was diagnosed with AIDS. When your lover Roger died in 86, did you feel like that was it at all? Do you know ever that like you wouldn't be able to have another lover again because the loss was so great? Or did you feel different than that? Like life is short and you were going to keep your heart open to other people.
I went from the first feeling to the second feeling over a period of about a year and a half. In the months after Roger died, I was crazy. I just was an insane person. I mean, the grief hit me like insanity. I remember thinking that the only reason to get up in the morning was that the dog had to be fed. I mean, I was that close to a kind of inside suicide. And I also had a record to leave. I mean, whatever writerly passion or ego had survived Roger's death consumed me during the next year as I wrote about him. And that definitely got me through. And I assumed that I would be diagnosed with some horror at any time. But by the time I met Stephen in the summer of 88, I really did feel, just as you said, I felt I might as well take a chance. What else is there? I've come to believe that, I mean, one of the things I say a lot is that I would rather be remembered for loving well than mm-hmm. writing well. I, as I said in Borrowed Time, I think that when people come to the end of their lives, as I've watched so many people do, what matters to them is how much they've loved. And, so as they say out here, nobody ever wanted to read one more screenplay on his deathbed. I was open to it. Stephen was less open to it. I had to pursue him, I think. And he said to me when I met him, you know, I have 7 friends who are going to die in the next 6 months. And they did, one after another. And it took a great, great toll on him. And at the end of that 6 months, he was diagnosed himself with KS. But as I said to him, after we'd been together for about a year or a year and a half, it was quite clear to both of us that we were able to be happy despite all the rage and pain we felt, because loving one another was so what we had spent our lives trying to find.
Is it okay for me to ask if you're a lover now as well?
Yes, sure. Winston, as far as we know, is very well and takes care of himself marvelously. I have hope that there are people who are fighting with the virus now, including millions of people in this country. That is a ridiculous figure that is given to us by the CDC week after week after week, that there's 1 million people infected. How can that be? I mean, it's much more likely to be 2 or 3 or 4 million. But I think that many of those people will have the chance to survive, that some of the new medication will really be dramatic breakthrough medication in 94 and 95. And I hope that Winston will be able to take advantage of that if necessary, and he may survive it. I'm writing a piece for WNET in New York, a fictional AIDS clinical drug trial, a miniseries about a group of people who come and try a new drug. And I really want to make it clear at the end of that a few of those people may well survive. They may well get 10 or 20 or 30 years.
You have a new memoir, and it's really your coming out story and the story of what your life was like when you had to cover up for who you were and you had to lie a lot before you came out. And you write in that book that every memoir now is a kind of manifesto. Before I ask you to read the opening of your new memoir, Becoming a Man, how sick were you when you were writing this? During how much of the time of writing this were you actually sick?
Fortunately, I was really not sick except for fevers during most of the year that I wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
I had wanted to write it because so many people had said to me about my relationship with Roger that it seemed like the perfect relationship, and they romanticized it a good deal, and as well they might. It was an incredible relationship. But I would often think, God, if anybody really understood the loser and the lost that I was during the 25 years before I met Roger, I probably need to tell them that I was the most, to me anyway, the most unlikely person to find a great love. And that's what spurred me on. What I didn't expect was how difficult it would be to actually confront the past honestly. During the first 50 pages of it, I would think, oh, everyone should do this. This is very exciting. And by the time I reached page 100, I thought, nobody should do this. This is too depressing.
Paul, let me ask you to read the beginning of your new memoir, Becoming a Man.
Okay. It begins with a kind of manifesto, actually. Everybody else had a childhood, for one thing, where they were coaxed and coached and taught all the shorthand. Or that's how it always seemed to me, eavesdropping my way through 25 years, filling in the stories of straight men's lives. First they had their shining boyhood, which made them strong and psyched them up for the leap across the chasm to adolescence, where the real rites of manhood began. I grilled them about it whenever I could, slipping the casual question in while I did their Latin homework for them, sprawled on the lawn at Andover under the reeling elms. And every year they leaped further ahead, leaving me in the dust with all my doors closed and each with a new and better deadbolt. Until I was 25, I was the only man I knew who had no story at all. I'd long since accepted the fact that nothing had ever happened to me, and nothing ever would. That's how the closet feels once you've made your nest in it and learned to call it home. Self-pity becomes your oxygen. 46 now, and dying by inches, I finally see how our lives align at the core, if not in the sorry details. I still shiver with a kind of astonished delight when a gay brother or sister tells of that narrow escape from the coffin world of the closet. Yes, 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 goes a voice in my head. It was just like that for me.
Are you planning on writing a memoir about having AIDS?
I'm in a little bit of crisis these days, wondering what I ought to write. Because I have been very moved by people's response to this autobiographical material, I realize that I have some more autobiography in me, and that maybe I will tackle that. I don't know. I don't want to trivialize anything in my own life, and I'm a little afraid of getting into the firestorms of it. But yes, I've really thought of that. I mean, it came to me the other night that I could write an essay about my dog, Puck. And I thought, my God, you've become a terrible sentimentalist in your old age. But Puck is a kind of figure who really is a bridge figure, who was very close to Roger and very close to Stephen, and he's very close to Winston. And I have a friend who walks around the house when we're away and he's house-sitting for us. He says, I walk around your house saying to Puck, what is the secret of life? And I sometimes feel that my dog has it. So I don't know. I'm still wondering about how to address all that. My opinions are so loud already about the government and the churches that I don't feel an urgency to peg my enemies as I used to in the past.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you the best and good health and so on.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Terry.
Paul Monette's new memoir is called Becoming a Man, Half a Life Story. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Thank you. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Ed Jones wanted to make sure people knew that Washington, D.C. was a real place, not just the city of glitz and politicians. So he wrote Lost in the City, a collection of stories about the African-American neighborhoods in which he was raised. Coming up, a talk with Ed Jones about the Washington, D.C. most Americans don't know. And book critic John Leonard reviews Watermark by Soviet emigre and Nobel Prize winner Joseph Brodsky. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Discussions at the International AIDS meeting in Amsterdam today focused on a Newsweek magazine report about a possible new AIDS virus. This report says about a dozen people are sick with AIDS, but do not seem to carry either of the two known forms of the AIDS virus. But NPR's Michael Schuller, reporting from Amsterdam, says that researchers don't see much evidence of a new AIDS virus.
A dozen people sick with AIDS and apparently not infected with the AIDS virus, HIV, is certainly puzzling, but not nearly proof that another AIDS virus is on the loose, according to experts gathered in Amsterdam. It could be, says Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health, that these patients have one of the two known types of HIV, but that the virus is hidden in their bodies, so standard tests don't find it. Fauci says this might happen in patients whose immune systems are so devastated that very few immune cells remain to harbor the virus. Or perhaps these people are infected with a mutated version of the AIDS virus, one so different it is not recognized by current tests. Isolated reports of sick AIDS patients without HIV are not new, but researchers say even if there is an undiscovered AIDS virus out there, it is so rare it shouldn't pose a serious health threat. This is Michael Schuller in Amsterdam.
Foreign ministers of the European Community meeting in Brussels have decided to push for Serbia and Montenegro to be expelled from international bodies, including the UN. This move came as fierce fighting in Bosnia shattered a ceasefire that had been slated to go into effect yesterday. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The EC foreign ministers said Serbia and Montenegro deserve most of the blame for the fighting in Bosnia. British Foreign Minister Douglas Hurd, just back from a tour of former Yugoslav republics, said he believed that authorities in the Serbian capital of Belgrade could influence what happens in Bosnia. Pro-Serbian forces in Bosnia reportedly get weapons and supplies from Serbia, and the Serbian government has so far backed the policy of ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, by which Muslims or Croats in villages the Serb declare to be theirs are kicked out or even killed. That policy and 3 months of war has produced more than 1 million refugees in Bosnia, but European governments so far have been slow to take them in. German Chancellor Helmut Kohl said today that his government is now preparing to take in more Bosnian refugees and urged his European counterparts to do the same. I'm Tom Gelton in Berlin.
A shooting incident has been reported in the parking area outside the Dirksen Federal Building in downtown Chicago. According to a local news report, the shooting involved a man on trial in connection with 8 bank robberies. Several people are said to have been wounded. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 28.5 points to close at 3,303. This is NPR News. In Florida, a lawsuit has been filed against Ross Perot in an effort to force him to be a presidential candidate this fall. The class action lawsuit accuses the Texas billionaire of a breach of promise and claims that many volunteers left their jobs to work on Perot's behalf. An attorney says while the lawsuit does not seek monetary damages, it does claim that campaign volunteers spent more than $50,000 of their own money on telephone calls and other campaign-related expenses. The Bush administration has stated repeatedly that the president will not launch his reelection bid until after the Republican convention in August, but his plans indicate otherwise. Mr. Bush will be campaigning heavily in the next few weeks in a dozen different states. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The president has told reporters on numerous occasions that he will not begin aggressively campaigning until after the Republican convention. But the president spent 2 hours today taping television ads for his reelection campaign. He released a travel schedule today that has him crisscrossing the country the next few weeks, and he participates tonight in a satellite briefing with supporters in 30 states. President Bush has fallen significantly behind Democratic presidential nominee Bill Clinton in public opinion polls. While Republicans say they plan to seriously undermine Clinton's support this fall, campaign surrogates such as Vice President Dan Quayle and Massachusetts Governor William Weld have already begun hitting. Key Republican leaders, however, say the Bush campaign is going to have to do better and have been advising the president to solicit the support of his former campaign advisor and current Secretary of State, James Baker. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
In northern Iraq, a car bomb exploded outside UN offices, slightly wounding two guards. The car blew up 15 minutes before a full lineup of UN guards. UN officials also say that protests in Baghdad are now on the increase. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For most of us, Washington, D.C. means politics and power. Edward Jones has written about another side of life in our nation's capital. Lost in the City is a collection of 14 stories set in African-American neighborhoods in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The White House, the Capitol, and the Supreme Court seem very far away. The book is on the Washington Post's bestseller list. Jones spoke with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person. First, he read an excerpt from his story, The Store. A young man is walking home after being fired from the job he held for 2 years at the Atlas Printing Company, a job where he never got a raise, where he saw young white men climb ahead of him to better positions, and where he was let go, the owner said, because of hard times. It's a freezing winter day.
My father always said that when the world pisses on you, it then spits on you to finish the job. At New York Avenue and Fifth, I crossed on the red light. A white cop twirling his billy club saw me and came to spit on me to finish up what Atlas had done. He asked me if I didn't know it was against D.C. and federal law to cross on the red light. I was only a few blocks from home, and maybe heat and thawing out my nuts were the only things on my mind, because I tried to be funny and told him the joke my father had always told, that I thought the green light was for white folks and the red light was for colored people. His face reddened big time. When my brother and I were in our early teens, my mother said this to us with the most seriousness she had ever said anything. Never, even if you become kings of the whole world, I don't want y'all messing with a white cop. The worst that my mother feared didn't happen to her baby boy that day. The cop only made me cross back on the green light and go all the way back to 7th Street, then come back to 5th Street and cross again on the green light, then go back to 7th to do it all over again. Then I had to do it twice more. I was frozen through and through when I got back to 5th the second time, and as I waited for the light to change after the fourth time, and he stood just behind me, I became very afraid, afraid that doing all that would not be enough for him, that he would want me to do more, and then even more after that, and that in the end I would be shot or simply freeze to death across the street from the number 2 police precinct. Had he told me to deny my mother and father, I think I would have done that too. I got across the street and went on my way, waiting for him to call me back. I prayed, just get me back to 115 New York Avenue safely, and I'll never come back to the world again. Just get me back to 115 New York Avenue safely. For days after that, I just hung out at home. My mother believed that a day had the best foundation if he had breakfast. So after she fixed our breakfast and went off to work, I went back to bed and slept to about noon. When I got some heart back, I started venturing out again, but I kept in my own neighborhood, my own world.
Okay, thank you, Ed Jones. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, boundaries and borders and people crossing over borders and boundaries and the consequences of that comes up a lot in your stories. What kinds of boundaries were you aware of when you were growing up?
I think there was never, for me, when I was a kid, there was never a sense that of going into white neighborhoods because all the neighborhoods I knew were black. I think the adults in my life probably confronted racism and all of that. But for children, the world was a relatively safe place. We had our stores, we had playgrounds, we had friends. And beyond all of that, there were the adults in the neighborhood who watched out for kids. So it was a fairly safe place in your own neighborhood. And if you ventured too far beyond that, then you were in a different world and you might encounter something you might not like.
How big was your neighborhood? How much, was it your block? Was it a few blocks?
It could be. It could be a few blocks. It could be one particular block. When I was living, I lived in Washington. By the time I was 18, I lived in about 18 different places. So for me, growing up, I had a variety of neighborhoods. That was just, my mother didn't, her job, she worked as a dishwasher in a restaurant for most of my childhood. And she didn't get very much money. And the result was that we moved into places that weren't very good. If you move, for example, into a place in the spring, you didn't know until that winter that there was no heat. So we would end up moving out of that place into another place that had its own problem. So we moved around a lot. For me, a neighborhood could be one particular street. On K Street, I remember, it was just that street. And as it turned out, we moved around the corner to Myrtle Street, which is the street in the story, The Girl Who Raised Pigeons. But all the time I was on K Street for about two or so years, I never knew one single person around the corner on Myrtle Street.
I want to ask you a little bit more about boundaries. You said that in your world you felt safe, but that the adults around you, you could kind of sense that when they ventured out into the wider world, either for work or whatever, going into the white world, what did you pick up from that? What did you sense from them?
Did they
tell you directly that there was danger out there?
Yeah, I think, no, as a matter of fact, I don't think many of them, they rarely talked about what happened on their jobs in Washington. A lot of the talk, a lot of the bad things that had happened to them had happened to them in the South. Because almost all the adults I knew as a child had come from the South. We were, I think, people of my generation were like the first to be born in Washington. Our parents, their friends, almost all the adults had come from the South. And so when they talked about bad things in the world, it was things in the South, racism. Now and again, things about the KKK, people having to flee because of this, that, and the other. But there was not very much talk. I mean, it was... And as far as work in Washington, it was hard work and whatever, but they didn't really go into much talk about racism. I don't know why it is. I think because Washington was a predominantly black city, and even though there was segregation there in the early years when I was growing up, they came back to a world that was wonderful. I remember when I lived on 10th Street, we had on U Street three movie theaters, and they were well kept. There were good movies there. So everything you needed was in your own world. And I suppose that kind of made up for whatever bad things that happened to people when they went on their jobs.
Writer Edward Jones is our guest, speaking with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Edward Jones, author of the new book, Lost in the City. Speaking with him is Fresh Air producer Naomi Person.
You grew up in a neighborhood called Shaw, I believe?
A variety of neighborhoods, Shaw and other places, yeah.
Right. How far were you from official Washington, the power and buildings? And
actually, not very far. When I lived, for example, on 10th Street, I lived at a 1700 block of 10th Street. At about the 400-600 block is Ford's Theater and also the house where Lincoln was shot and killed. So relatives would come from out of town, and we would just walk all the way down 10th Street and start sightseeing right there at Ford's Theater and the house where Lincoln was shot. But after you cross certain streets, it depends on the street, then you would begin to see a number of more and more white people. and you would know you were no longer in your own neighborhood.
How did you feel? I mean, how did that feel? Did you have to change your behavior? Did you have to watch out for things? Comfortable? Was it uncomfortable?
I think because as a child, there's a certain cockiness that goes with it. So we really didn't change our behavior very much because we hadn't learned that was what you should do. I was raised by my mother primarily, and my mother was a very gentle, and in some instances, she could be very meek. So she never really got around to telling me all the things that I should know about being in a white world. So we really weren't any different. We were just children.
Right.
I remember in 1964, I went and visited South Boston, Virginia. And that was the summer that the Civil Rights Bill was passed. And I didn't think very much of it then. It was only years later that I began to see that it was a very different atmosphere down there, because when I went to the theater, I had to sit in the balcony, and which was something very strange, because in D.C., all our theaters, of course, were black, and you could sit wherever you want. I remember, too, that the day the Civil Rights Bill was passed, my cousins were very excited because now they could go to the white swimming pool. They didn't have any swimming pool of their own. And I couldn't share in their joy because I didn't understand what all the excitement was about. First of all, I was too young, and also I had come from Washington where you could go to any swimming pool practically that you wanted. Mm-hmm. It was just really strange to see them all so happy about something that I didn't think was a big deal.
Right. Did you participate at all, or were you too young to participate in some of the political protests and action, the Poor People's Campaign, Martin Luther King's March on Washington? Were you aware of those things?
I was too young for one thing, and I didn't have any political consciousness at that time. In 63, I believe it was, when they had the March on Washington, we had just gotten our first television set, a used thing I think my mother bought for about $50. And because it was so new, I think I ran in and out of the house that day, of our apartment that day, turning it on just to get, this whole idea of a new television set. And all that day on the television, there was this march and these people making the speeches. But it had no relationship to me. I didn't feel that, it was taking place, for example, way, way down at the Washington Monument. And it didn't mean anything to me because that... I had no idea what was going on.
It sounds in a lot of ways like you were really protected in your neighborhood. And you said that, when you would walk into, start walking into the white world, you hadn't learned about the white world. Like,
no.
Your mother never told you what you needed to know.
When did you start
learning?
I think in 1966, because that was the first year I really began to read a lot. Up until I was about 13 or 14, all I read was what was called funny books, which are comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think in 65, I was in Brooklyn, New York, and I read for the first time Native Son. And things began to, there was a sense there that there was something more that I didn't really know. And then in 66, I began to read a whole lot, particularly a lot of Southern authors. I remember I read a lot of Erskine Caldwell, and there was a book called Hurry Sundown, which was a really big novel about the South and the civil rights movement, the civil rights era, and white and black characters. Also, I began high school, and I think things just began to open up, and they opened up even more when I went away to college in 68.
When you went away to college, you went to Holy Cross College?
In Worcester, Massachusetts.
In Worcester, Massachusetts. What was that like? I mean, Worcester is, kind of a working class town, about an hour or so from Boston.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. First of all, I was homesick. I had never been away from home so long, so far away. And then there was this black kid who was used to being surrounded by black people. All of a sudden, I was surrounded by white people. It was just, the experience is, it was just like being taken out and just plunged into a totally, and at times hostile environment. And I think that was why there were about 50 or so black students at that time, and we kind of rallied around and kind of gave each other comfort. But my mother had never spoken to me about what I could expect, what would happen, because she was an uneducated woman. But I just sort of made my way as best I could.
Mm-hmm. What were some of your difficult experiences, your first, you know, experiences that you remember that you just kind of stopped yourself and said, you know, how did I end up here?
Yeah. My roommate was a white guy, and I don't remember what city he lived in, somewhere in Massachusetts, but whenever his parents would come and bring him something, they would always stay downstairs, and he never once introduced me to them. I went away one weekend, and I had a poster of Eldridge Cleaver on the front on my door, and some guy got drunk one night and decided to tear it down. There were just a few slights along the way. I remember I would stand in French class, and this guy, we were standing in the back. I think we would recite the Lord's Prayer or something in the beginning of the class. And this guy would always turn around and look at me. I mean, it was just, his eyes told me, well, you're not really supposed to be there. And I think I made an effort that first semester to go to church, because I hadn't been going to church in many years. And I went. I remember one evening I was in church, I think it was a midnight mass or something, and I saw this guy, he didn't see me, and it occurred to me, well, if he's here in church and I'm here in church, one of us really doesn't belong, and I never went back anymore.
I have a question for you about your mother. In hearing your stories about her and what she didn't, and a lot of times did not tell you, it reminds me a lot of, you know, how a kid, when they either find out about sex from their parents or they don't. Did you ever kind of have a talk with her afterwards and kind of say what, you know, resolve that with her?
No, and I regret that. She died in 1975, and I regret that. That kind of feeling I wanted to put in the story of The Lost in the City, because, you know, once death happens, you know, all of that my mother was and knew, the woman she was lost, and I'm always aware of that now, particularly as the years go on, and I get closer to the age she was when she died. And I put that feeling into the story that once, you know, that this woman is dead, and now all of that is gone. But no, I never had any sit down and had any talk with her, and I regret that very, very much.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious also, there are a lot of writers in this country and who have sort of worked regional areas into their stories and kind of had that be the framework of their fiction. Were you influenced by any of these writers?
I didn't realize this until a few weeks ago. Someone had mentioned this. But the first time I read Joyce's Dubliners, something clicked in my mind, and I said, I want to do this for Washington, D.C., for the world that I knew. And I didn't, I think that happened so long ago that I'd simply forgotten that that had been the initial inspiration, because I didn't really have any stories in my head when I read Dubliners. I just knew that somewhere along the line I wanted to do that. But I think that was the beginning of it, when I read those stories and all those wonderful people in Dublin. And I knew that, you know, that just as many wonderful people were living in Washington. Of course, you never hear about it, because all you hear about is Capitol Hill, White House, the politicians, et cetera. But I knew there was a variety of people, wonderful people in Washington, and I wanted to do the same thing that Joyce had done.
Edward Jones' new collection of short stories is called Lost in the City. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tom Gelton reports on the problem of refugees from Bosnia fleeing the fighting in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The question is, what is Europe going to do about the thousands of these refugees? A report on refugees who have fled Mali going to Mauritania. Also, Secretary of State James Baker talks with Palestinian leaders in West Jerusalem. Robert Siegel and a discussion about professionalism in the Olympics. And now, the American hope in the Tour de France is Andy Hampsten. Greg LeMond is out of the race due to a knee problem and exhaustion. And we'll be discussing what's going to happen in the rest of the Tour de France with the reporter Samuel Apt.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Joseph Brodsky is a Nobel Prize-winning Russian poet who lives in voluntary exile in America. Since leaving his home, he's made several visits to Venice. He has a new collection of essays about Venice titled Watermark. Critic John Leonard has a review.
Back in Mother Russia, a young Joseph Brodsky dreamt of a Venice, aristocratic, darkish, cold, dimly lit, he says, with twangs of Vivaldi and Cherubini in the background, with Bellini, Tiepolo, Titian-draped female bodies for clouds. I vowed to myself that should I ever get out of my empire, should this eel ever escape the Baltic, the first thing I would do would be to come to Venice, rent a room on the ground floor of some palazzo, so that the waves raised by the passing boats would splash against my window, write a couple of elegies while extinguishing my cigarettes on the damp, stony floor, cough and drink, and when the money got short, instead of boarding a train, buy myself a little Browning and blow my brains out on the spot, unable to die, in Venice, of natural causes. Well, most of us who go to Venice will bring back picture postcards. And if we'd been as clever as Mary McCarthy, we might have brought back one of the best guidebooks ever written. But you have to be a brilliant poet, a Nobel Prize winner, to bring back what Brodsky brought, which is an essay on water and light, space and time, music and love, even a sort of epistemology of metaphor. Watermark floats. In this, it's dreamlike. And as Brodsky tells us, should dreams ever be designated a genre, their main stylistic device would doubtless be the non sequitur. Although there are epigrams like dolphins in this dream pool, and witty, sometimes ferocious remarks on Freud and Pound and Stravinsky, on the bull in the labyrinth and the plague in literature, the language of Brodsky ripples inward. The boat's slow progress through the night, he says, was like the passage of coherent thought through the subconscious. For 17 years, every winter break from the American university where he teaches, Brodsky has gone to Venice, a city that returns to him not his identity, but his anonymity. A city, he says, narcissistic enough to turn your mind into an amalgam, unburdening it of its depths. Look at the zinc-covered cupolas, like teapots, and the campaniles, like melting spoons. No egoist can stare for long in this porcelain setting by crystal water, for it steals the show. But there's something fishy about Venice, too. Streets meandering like eels bring us to a flounder of a campo with a cathedral in the middle of it, barnacled by saints. And the eye that swims in such beauty is also a form of marine life, our only raw, fish-like internal organ. It darts, flaps, oscillates, dives, rolls up. Its exposed jelly dwells with atavistic joy on reflected palazzi, spiky heels, gondolas. And here Brodsky gets tricky. It is as though space, he says, cognizant here more than any place else of its inferiority to time, answers it with the only property time doesn't possess, with beauty. And that's why water takes this answer, twists it, wallops it, and shreds it, but ultimately carries it by and large intact, often to the Adriatic. And what is beauty but, quote, the distribution of light in a fashion most congenial to one's retina? Which leads Brodsky, after digressing on music, canals as bars, tides as scores, gondolas as violins, to consider love and fidelity and betrayal. Love, he defines, as an affair between a reflection and its object. And suddenly it occurs to me that these reflections in his golden eye are tears, that the poet has something more personal in mind, that Venice is just an excuse to dream about Venus.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Watermark by Joseph Brodsky. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Stephen Waterman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Siberia, we talk with journalist Frederick Kemp about his travels through the place he describes as the soul of Russia. Kemp traveled through parts of Siberia no American had ever been to before. Kemp has been a foreign correspondent for Newsweek and The Wall Street Journal. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.